Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. We've got an action-packed installment planned for you this week as we kick off our first show of 2020. Jennifer Blair of Alberta Farmer Express will tell us about how Club Root continues to slowly and quietly march through that province in 2019. Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm will inform us of the latest ups and downs of commodities. And Glacier Farm Media's Ottawa correspondent, David Fraser, will tell us a bit about how the federal agriculture minister is making the case for farmers in cabinet. But up first, we've got Barb Glenn of the Western Producer to talk about a topic sure to send a chill down the spine of many producers, agriculture after glyphosate. Barb, thanks for joining us today. The concept of agriculture after glyphosate is a real attention grabber, but how real is this possibility and what's driving this concern?
Well, driving the concern is health. People are concerned that glyphosate might adversely affect their health. As to how real the possibility is, restrictions on glyphosate use globally is the more common scenario at present. Relatively few countries have outright banned glyphosate. But there have been a number of lawsuits, successful lawsuits, suggesting that glyphosate causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And juries have awarded quite large settlements, but those have been challenged and appealed. So we will see how those pan out.
So what will that future look like? Are there enough new products coming to replace this one?
Well, as you know, glyphosate was a groundbreaking, revolutionary chemical widely used for and the most effective solution to weed challenges. So there is a lot of concern in the farm community about that. There's been emphasis in the scientific community on developing new modes of action, but that is a time-consuming and expensive process. So what it might mean for our farmers, should they lose the use of glyphosate, will be turning to more tillage, possibly. There are some technical solutions like targeted weed control that's being made possible through various technical advancements.
Are other products under similar threat adding to the problem?
Yeah, that does seem to be fairly common. Anytime you say the word chemical, it raises a red flag, even though chemicals are responsible for a lot of our health and safety. One of the ones also under threat, according to my sources, is paraquat, which is much more toxic than glyphosate. Paraquat, though, isn't so far under the same publicly voiced threats as glyphosate. But it would be a concern if farmers turn to more toxic chemicals should they lose the use of glyphosate.
Are the reduced tillage production systems like zero-till, they rely heavily on glyphosate. What will this mean for them?
Yeah, there's a real possibility that losing some of our chemical solutions to weed control will result in more tillage. And if, as you know, there's a huge emphasis on soil health now. And we know from scientists that excessive tillage harms the soil. And so, there's going to be rather a serious trade-off should we have to trade in glyphosate for other methods of weed control.
And what's being done in other areas? Are there other strategies like fall weed seed control? What do they look like? I've heard some real horror stories out of places like Australia and the southern U.S.
There's been a lot of interest in post-harvest weed seed control and destruction. I think in most farm publications, people will have seen stories about weed destructors. These are mechanisms that capture weed seeds and crush them and otherwise destroy them so that they don't survive in the soil to become problems. So those have been tested in Canada, and they are widely used in Australia, according to one of my sources. is Dr. Hugh Becky, who is at the forefront of resistant weed research. And so there's that. There is some LIDAR work being done. Drones could possibly be used to identify weeds. And then with there are various technical solutions to target specific weeds. For example, targeted spraying that just sprays weeds that are found in the field when being used on farm equipment as they across the landscape. There are a few options, but many of them are still in the infant stages, if you will, testing stages, so not readily available yet.
That's great. Thanks for that report, Barb.
Well, you're welcome, Gord. Appreciate the chance.
That was Barb Glenn of The Western Producer telling us about how some weed scientists think agriculture needs to start thinking of life after glyphosate. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later in the show, we'll be speaking to Glacier Farm Media's Ottawa correspondent, David Fraser, about how Federal Agriculture Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau is hoping to make the case for business risk management enhancements and carbon tax relief. Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm will make some sense of the markets for us. But up next, we've got Jennifer Blair of Alberta Farmer Express. She recently reported that despite not grabbing many headlines, the canola disease clubroot is still continuing its assault on Alberta. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what can you tell us about the current situation with clubroot? How widespread has it now become?
You know, I write about clubroot year after year, and it's almost always the same story. You know, clubroot is spreading, clubroot is getting worse, clubroot is overcoming resistance. And 2019 was really no different here in Alberta, with about another 300 cases cropping up in the province across just about 50 counties. So it almost kind of feels inevitable at this point that it will hit most, if not all, farms across the province eventually.
So that's got to be alarming then for the people in the business. What are they saying about that?
You know, it's so interesting. The fellow here in the province who actually confirmed the first case of clubroot, Dan Orchard, really did say that it reminds him of the early days of clubroot where, you know, there was no resistant varieties. So, you know, I think he is a little nervous about that, and rightfully so, I think.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I've heard people say that they felt like resistant varieties were the solution, but it appears that resistance being rapidly overcome. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, Alberta farmers have been leaning quite heavily on resistant varieties to manage clubroot since they first came out about a decade ago. And I think that's part of the reason that we're still seeing that spread, as well as these resistance being overcome. The genetics were so good that farmers didn't always feel that they needed to adjust their management practices too, like extending their rotations or sanitizing their equipment. So now we've had cycle after cycle of resistant varieties in heavily infested fields in some parts of the province with no real way to decrease the spore loads. So that's put selection pressure on that resistance. So it's almost a perfect storm for clubroot. And so now, you know, the University of Alberta researchers there have now identified 36 different clubroot pathotypes in the province. And some of those new pathotypes have begun to overcome the first round of resistance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember some years ago now talking to a gentleman from the University of Alberta, Stephen Strelkov, and he described clubroot as highly adaptable. So it sounds like that's really playing out and that he was correct when he said that years back.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing that quite heavily here in Alberta, but I suspect that's something that we are going to see across the provinces and across the prairies, you know, if clubroot continues to spread.
So now what does this mean for canola growers in the region then, especially the ones in the areas that have had it for a while and the resistance is breaking down?
Yeah. So essentially, you know, it kind of puts Alberta canola growers back at square one with this disease. And I think that's pretty scary. You know, when clubroot is overcoming resistance faster than new genetics are coming out, farmers aren't really left with a whole lot of options aside from some kind of time-consuming and potentially costly management practices. I don't think that anybody in the industry really wants that.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting. Like, I'm sitting here in Manitoba where we have a handful of confirmed cases, and it seems to be spreading, but it doesn't seem to be a problem. And I'm wondering, is, you know, should our growers here and growers in Saskatchewan and areas that aren't affected, you know, should we be looking at Alberta, and are there lessons there that should be learned?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the real big messages that are coming out of groups like the Canola Council, you know, that if you're in an area that isn't affected, you need to be taking proactive management measures now to prevent the disease from getting that stranglehold on your operation. So the Canola Council has actually come out with a really great recipe for club root management that includes some of those proactive management tips, like scouting your fields and keeping at least a two-year break between canola crops, and, you know, using resistant varieties and kind of managing the way that your soil moves on your operation. So I think that a lot of farmers have shied away from some of those management practices because of the time or cost associated with them. But, you know, it doesn't really have to be all or nothing. Sanitizing your equipment is a great example. You might not be able to take 3 hours between fields to fully sanitize your equipment, but by just taking 15 or 20 minutes to knock off that loose dirt, you can reduce your risk quite a bit. So, you know, I think Dan Orchard probably said it best when he said, you know, it's okay if you can't do everything, but it's not okay to do nothing. So I'm kind of hoping that that's something Alberta farmers and farmers across the prairies keep in mind as they try to manage club root in 2020.
And is this one of those cases where it is better to know? I know that I think a lot of times it's human nature. If there's a problem, you know, I mean, I don't like to go to the doctor for every little thing because I'm afraid of what I might find out. And I wonder if it's the same with farmers and this disease, that sometimes they willfully don't really look for it. And should they be looking for it because it's an easier problem to solve when it's small?
Definitely. You know, I've heard farmers in the past kind of compare this a little bit to a cancer diagnosis. You know, obviously it's terrible to get that diagnosis, but you can't manage it if you don't know that it's there. You know, I think there's a little bit of a stigma about admitting that you have club root, but you're not ever going to be able to get ahead of it unless you know, scout for it and acknowledge that you have the problem and get as much help as you can to deal with it.
That's very interesting. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today to tell us about this.
Thanks again for having me.
That was Jennifer Blair of Alberta Farmer Express telling us about club root's continued advance in that province. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. A little later, we'll be wrapping up the show with a look at the markets from reporter Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm. But first, we're leaving Alberta and heading east to Ottawa, where we'll be touching base with Glacier Farm Media Ottawa correspondent David Fraser. He's been watching the Federal Ag Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau's efforts to advocate for the sector in government. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So in the past couple of weeks, I've seen the minister seeking evidence to make her case for carbon tax relief and business risk management enhancements. Exactly what are she and her staff saying?
So essentially her staff and the minister herself are saying that they want more information, more data from the provinces and from industry groups on the impact of carbon pricing, or when it comes to business risk management programs, how those programs are working. She's basically saying, I want to do an information gathering exercise and get as much data and info from industry and provinces as she can.
I think that maybe tells us a little bit about how her role in the cabinet and the cabinet itself works. Sometimes I think there's a perception that, well, the minister should just be able to make things happen or fix it or do whatever needs to be done. But the reality is, isn't it that she's got to convince her colleagues in cabinet of a lot of things first?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, when you think of cabinet, it is basically different factions of a government competing for a finite amount of dollars or specific action on a file. And to do that effectively, you do have to have a good argument. So Minister Bibeau is making the point that she's trying to build this case to convince her colleagues that perhaps farmers need more relief from carbon pricing and perhaps business risk management programs need to be improved. But in order to do that, yeah, she has to make a case at the table. And as she says, she can't just go off of the feelings of farmers.
Yeah, I think that's key. I've heard her say she needs evidence and hard evidence and statistics and so on. So knowing that, knowing how she has to advocate within cabinet, What can the sector itself, the groups in the and companies and whatnot in the sector, and perhaps the provincial governments and so on, the people who want to see this action, what can they do then? What can they help her to come up with to make these points?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, I think throughout 2019, industry groups, and I know provinces as well, they spent a lot of the past year, and particularly the 2019 harvest season, costing out the impact of something like the carbon price this year, collecting that data. And to me, this is this is effective. I think we can expect them to share their findings with Minister Bibo if they haven't already. I know that there are some preliminary results from some industry groups on the prairies of what they found. And those results are showing that, yeah, something like the carbon pricing is costing farmers money this year or this past year. So I think continuing to do that is about as effective as they can, essentially help Minister Bibo in her objective of getting information.
And now I accept, as I ask you this question, that you don't personally sit at the cabinet table, but you're also a lot closer to it than I am. Do you have any sense as to what some of the key stumbling blocks are that need to be overcome on the, let's say, the two key issues, the BRM enhancements and the carbon tax?
Sure. Well, the easiest thing to point to is cost. I think specifically with business risk management and improving something like agri stability, we know that's going to cost more money. Minister Bibo knows that's going to cost more money. And we also know that the federal government doesn't have a ton of money sitting around right now. The last fiscal update showed that the deficit is even higher than it was originally expected. So spending is tough to come by. Even though it might not seem like that when you look at the deficit numbers. But in any case, the cost of improving something like BRM programs is a major stumbling block. When it comes to carbon pricing, I think, and we've heard this from Bibo, she recognizes this need to continue to address climate change, and she wants to ensure that the agricultural industry is doing its part to reduce emissions, but do that while also not suffering undue consequences, I suppose. And if the federal government were to, say, offer exemptions for more exemptions on farms for grain drying, just as an example, that's going to result in lost revenue from the carbon pricing system. The federal government says, yeah, okay, well, the federal carbon pricing system is revenue neutral, so this really shouldn't matter, but every dollar in, every dollar out counts right now. So I would say cost is sort of the biggest stumbling block right now.
And one final question. This is a minister from Quebec who is advocating on behalf of Western farmers, and I think reasonably well. But I wonder, is Western agriculture suffering a bit for not having its own voice at the cabinet table in terms of like a minister at that regional level? Like I'm thinking of a Ralph Goodale.
Sure. Well, I think the short and easy answer to that question is yes, absolutely. Because in the absence of a Westerner or somebody with a farming background who understands farming, Bibo has to do what she's doing now. She needs to collect more information. She has to really come with a data evidence driven argument to her cabinet colleagues in order to convince them to give more money or take action on a specific file. If you're somebody who comes from Western Canada or a farming background and you're in that same position, well, you have a little bit more clout on the file than Minister Bibo perhaps would with her colleagues. And so I would say that, yeah, there is a little bit of suffering here as a result of not having a Westerner at the table. And it is worth pointing out, as you did, that's no fault of Bibo. She can't change where she's from. And I think, at least from my perspective, majority of folks that I talk to in the industry do believe that she's doing her best to advocate on behalf of agriculture and farmers. But if she grew up on a farm and could go to the table and say, hey, on my family farm, carbon pricing is having an impact, her colleagues around the table would probably just believe her and say, okay, well, let's do something about it. She wouldn't have to wait months while industry groups and provinces collect a bunch of data for her.
Well, thanks a lot for filling us in on this, David.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
That was Glacier Farm Media Ottawa correspondent David Fraser filling us in on some of the machinations in the nation's capital. This is Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm this week's host, Gord Gilmore. Now, last but certainly not least, we're joined by Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm to fill us in on the commodity markets. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Gord.
So we're just through the holiday season, which in my experience is usually a bit of a dead zone for the markets. Was that sort of business as usual this year?
It was starting out to be like that. The USDA has this big supply and demand report coming out this Friday, followed by next week's signing of the Phase 1 trade agreement between the US and China. The markets were kind of in a holding pattern. Then lo and behold, there's turmoil in the Middle East after the U.S. assassinates that Iranian general. The Chicago markets just plummet.
Not what you want to hear. Now you alluded to those supply and demand numbers coming out later this week. What is the trade expecting in those?
They're expecting lower corn production, lower soybean production, due in part to the horrible harvest the U.S. Northern Plains had. Right now, they're looking at, you know, maybe 13.5 billion bushels of corn. That's down a little from the last report. Soybeans are supposed to come in around 3.5 billion bushels. That's down about 40 million bushels. But we'll see. You know, a lot of the predictions going into a supply and demand report, you know, all of a sudden the USDA pulls a fast one and the numbers could be a lot lower, or they may stay the same.
And China and U.S. Trade relations, they've had a huge influence on the market in the last while. You alluded earlier, there's that so-called Phase 1 deal. What's this really going to mean, though? I've heard everything from it's the solution to it's really a whole lot of nothing and everything in between.
Yeah, until the U.S. and China actually sign the deal, we won't know what the details are. There is a lot of speculation that China's supposed to buy $40 billion worth of U.S. agricultural goods, but China won't confirm that. There's talk now that it's supposed to be $80 million spread out over 2 years.
Million or billion?
Billion, right. I should say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And either way, it's going to be a record. The most China's ever bought is $27 billion. So we'll see what happens. The markets are skeptical, due in part because, you know, China hasn't given those details of what's all in the deal. And the Chinese president is not coming to Washington. He's sending his vice premier instead.
And now, even assuming that they do buy in those volumes that we've seen sort of being mooted around about it, is that good news for a farmer that's not American, though? You know, I mean, there's sort of a finite amount of demand out there. And what you're really saying is that a lot of that demand is going to be locked into a trade deal that guarantees these purchases. So do we know how that plays out for the rest of the world?
What we're hoping to see is there be spillover from soybeans onto a canola. It may not, you know, a canola may not go up as much as soybeans, but hopefully there will be some a spillover.
Mm. And then, of course, as you alluded to earlier, again, the U.S.-Iran situation. What is happening there and what will it mean for markets?
Well, the United States used a drone attack to assassinate the top general who was in charge of their organization to help terrorists in other countries. That, you know, obviously ticked off Iran. There's a lot of turmoil over, you know, is oil still going to get through from the Middle East, because Iran has now said that they're going to retaliate. We just don't know when. They say they have 13 targets, and Trump responded, says, well, you have 13, I have 52 targets.
You can always count on the president to ramp things up a little these days, can't you? Now, in terms of the effect on crude oil, though, like, do we really know, like, does Iran still have the same capacity to affect that? I mean, yes, if they start to interfere with crude oil shipments, sure, prices will go up. Mm-hmm. But we're not in an era where oil's at $120 a barrel anymore, right? So, no. I mean, it seems to me that the economies could absorb a bit of an increase in that area.
Yeah, oil did go up just over $70 a barrel. Now it's come down. I do believe it closed yesterday around $68 a barrel. But until that situation diffuses, you know, there's still worries that oil could go back to $100 a barrel. You know, the British are already sending ships to escort British tankers through the Persian Gulf. As we've seen before, the pipeline going to Western Saudi Arabia is vulnerable to attacks itself.
Well, thanks, Glenn. I appreciate you filling us in on this.
Okay, thank you, Gord.
That was Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm filling us in on what's going on in commodities. That's another edition of Between the Rows wrapping up. We wish you all a happy new year, and we hope you'll join us again next week. In the meantime, I'm this week's host, Gord Gilmore, saying so long and stay warm.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.